And we're having just break open moments of like witnessing and breaking the code of silence that our community has just been choked with.
Welcome to the Social Fabric Podcast with me, Andrea Splendori. And this week, my guest is Guru Nishan Khalsa. Guru Nishan is an alchemist, soul provocateur, and a breath trainer. She's also the host of a podcast called Uncomfortable Conversations, the untold stories of the 3HO Kundalini Yoga community. In our conversation, we discuss the allegations of abuse that have affected the 3HO community globally, as well as Guru Nishan's personal story. The songs in this podcast have been shortened for rights reason. You can find the full song on Social Fabric playlist on Spotify. The show is also broadcast weekly on Dublin's Near FM 90.3. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
Well, thanks a million for joining. And first of all, I just as a caveat, I just like to say I know your brother Prab very, very well. In fact, I was thinking the other day, so how do I describe Prab? He's definitely one of my best friends. I was best man. He was best man at my wedding, and I actually married him. I did the celebration with Akasha, so I was the guy that did the whole process of marrying Prav and Susanna. So anyway, it's fantastic, man. And I was thinking it was only 4 years we kind of spent together in India, but they were very intense years. And that's where I met you first. I met you in India all those years ago. I don't know, it must be 25 years ago. So, but tell us a bit about you. Give us a bit of background. Who am we talking to? Tell us about those years ago and back those times.
Yeah, the time that we met, I think I was around maybe like 18 or 19. And I was in East Africa and I had come kind of as a respite to visit my brother because he was living in India. But I was born and raised in Phoenix. My parents joined Kundalini yoga meditation, kind of spiritual community that morphed into a religious community in like 1969. And then I was born and raised into that lifestyle. And my mom left the community real early. There was a lot of early hypocrisy and incongruency that she wasn't digging at all. But my dad was kind of like the head dude of our ashram and kind of dug that level of power on some level. But he also, you know, lived a very double life. And so very young, I think I tuned into, it helped that my mom was kind of loudly saying, hey, some of this stuff doesn't make any sense, you know, but also witnessing my dad's infidelity and just kind of noticing, wow, the community is teaching one thing and living something else. And that level of hypocrisy, I think, grated on me real young and early. And so by, you know, 15 or so, I was pretty much not so interested in the religious lifestyle I came from. But I felt at the time that there were still like real valuable things. And so my narrative, I think, through most of my life, but definitely from like 15 to like 30, was I grew up in this religious, you know, the spiritual community that, you know, I shed the religious dogma aspects and kept like the health consciousness. And I really lived with this philosophy that I thought that we got some like really beautiful foundational principles around health and health consciousness. And that started to kind of prove itself true to me over the last like 10 years or so, when Kundalini yoga started getting more and more popularized and a lot of the lifestyle habits we were raised with got popularized, like cold showers or whole foods or, you know, just all the trendy health things. And I'm only contexting all this because most of my life, I felt like I was gleaming the good from where I came from. And I think that's a beautiful principle or way to live my life. But what I know now, and only really in context for the last 5 years, and in specifically the last year, I know how much of my life patterns were actually trauma responses. And I never looked at my life or my childhood as traumatic. I thought it was amazing, right? And yet I also knew there were a lot of not amazing things. So anyway, that's an interesting context because I feel like that's really informed my life's work and what I'm here to share about my own story, not just on this podcast, but for the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to get to that in a minute. But just to keep it in context, a lot of people listen to this might not know. Like when I first met your brother, Prab and Akasha, so I had long hair and I had a beard because I was a bit of a hippie. They had long hair. They had a beard because they were a part of Sikhism movement. And this was in India. It's two American dudes, really cool guys. And the whole thing for me was just, I never heard of it. I never heard, like I knew Sikhism, but I never heard of this second generation Sikhs from California. And the stories, there's millions and millions of stories, and I'm waiting for Prab to come on the podcast to tell me a few, and so is Akasha. But all what I remember very clearly, one day we all went to Amsterdam to see Data and all the other guys. There was a big reunion. We all went to Amsterdam, and I always remember going around Amsterdam with a group of the guys all wearing turban, all wearing white. And Amsterdam is a pretty relaxed place, pretty forward thinking, but it was the first time in my life I ever felt part of a minority. Really, it was really weird. Like I never felt before or after. And I remember meeting you and you were wearing, I don't know if it's called the term, so there was a physicality, there was something exterior as well. There was all of that going on. So tell me about that, like Phoenix, Arizona, and what was it like as a teenager?
Yeah, I mean, you know, growing up, I think it's a really interesting mixed bag because we were really conditioned to be very proud of being different, you know, and yet very different, you know, to be growing up in the 70s or the 80s wearing turbans and beards and not going to doctors. Like all of these things were so weird. So we were just constantly weirdos. But, you know, I remember by first grade, like, this is us. Like, they're like, why do you wear that thing on your head? And we're like, it's not a thing. It's our hair. And why do you cut, you know, what's under there? We're like, it's our hair, stupid. You know, like we were just so proud of being who we were, which has its own danger because I remember kids growing up and then kind of looking very judgmental, like, ooh, you're eating meat. That's terrible, you know? And so like even young, I remember thinking like, even if these lifestyle choices are really the greatest ones, judging others that don't do it can't be good, you know? But you just don't think of those things. You just kind of, you grow up in something. And I loved our community. I loved the fact that we had an extended family. There were just so many things that I really enjoyed about it. My mom had left very early and got ostracized. So she was also getting the brunt of like what happened when somebody chose another life, you know, and people were, you know, really ostracized or put down and called sluts and prostitutes and cockroaches, just terrible, terrible things. So right within this beautiful kind of compassionate, loving, supposedly unconditional space, there was lots of kind of like thickly laden, judgmental, fear-based rules that as a kid, you don't know that that's fear. You just think that this is the way it is, you know? And there's just so many things I could say about that, about, you know, the pride of growing up feeling like there's something special about you. Mm. And only now do I kind of really have a context for that in the context of white superiority or spiritual superiority. Mm. And that was like an actual seed planted in us to be like, we have special knowledge and we're here to bring it to the world.
And so you went off then when I met you. So you were about, you say you were 18 or 19 or thereabouts when you came to visit Prab in India, and you were traveling through East Africa at that stage.
Yeah, you know, I didn't go to school in India. When I was five, my oldest brother, Prab, went to school in India, and there was a big movement to send all the kids to school in India. And me and another brother of mine, Kieran, he didn't get to go either. And, you know, as kids that didn't get to go to India, you know, you feel like bummed out, you know, you're not a part of the crew. And because we had Prob, he scooped us in and we got to meet all the friends and kind of like have that kind of older brother in move. But yeah, I just think that there was this seed in me of like, you know, I grew up around friends that were international most of my life. And I just had this international bug in me, but I don't know what it was, but I was never interested in Indian culture. You know, Indian men kind of was like, and a lot of the old stories of the gurus never interested me growing up, and all of it just felt a little bit far removed. And African culture always just interested me a little bit more. I remember a lady coming to live in our ashram when I was a kid, and she had worked in the Peace Corps. And she taught us like all these African dancing and African, like she was teaching us about building gardens and just all these things that kind of inspired African awareness in me. And then in high school, you know, before I even went to Africa, actually at 15, my dad and my stepmom moved to Minnesota and they left the community. And that blew my mind. As a 15-year-old, I just couldn't imagine life outside of the context of this ashram. And, you know, kids moved all the time and lived with other people. So I thought I might move somewhere else, but live with another family. And that was more normal to me than my family moving as a whole unit. So when he left, I didn't realize he was, quote, leaving the Dharma or anything. I don't think in his mind he framed it that way. But Minnesota was a big, big transition for me. It was the first time we were out of the community. I witnessed my dad as an alcoholic for the first time. And he was a closet alcoholic. You know, he was an amazing yoga teacher. He was an amazing human being and helped so many people. And especially the young generation, that Prabh's generation, that were transitioning from India into American life and questioning a lot about drugs and lifestyle. And because my dad was his own hidden addict, he had a philosophy around drugs and using and things that I think really helped a lot of them at the time. But I got to see my dad in a light that I don't think my brothers got to, because he came like crashing down off a pedestal, which he shouldn't have been on in the first place. But, you know, we tend to put our parents on pedestals, but especially when they put themselves there. And I just watched him be a drunken stupor and realized, wow, he's just a man struggling with his problems. And I told him, I was like, you hypocrite. You wouldn't let me eat sugar. You wouldn't let me cut my hair. You wouldn't let me get my ears pierced. You wouldn't let me shave my legs. You're making me philosophize to you about why I want to shave my legs when I'm in seventh grade going to public school. And you're drinking like this, you know, like it just, I lost it. And so here I became friends with my dad because we had it out. And that, yeah, that was big.
Right. Let me ask you one thing first. Let me break it with a song, which is the first song you picked, and then I ask you a little bit more. So you picked Nas, If I Ruled the World. Why did you pick that song?
So that actually jumps forward. When I was 18, I moved to East Africa. And then I lived in South Africa after that. And the reason I ended up in South Africa, in Kenya, I just kind of lived and traveled around and I met my former husband, Faiswali, there. And I was doing school as an independent learner. And I had learned from another kid that had grown up in our ashram that there was an ashram in South Africa. And so I had written to this ashram in South Africa saying, hey, I grew up in 3HO and I'm an independent student and I'm doing my university work as I travel Africa. Can I come and live there and work with you? And I was looking for a way to make money because I had this awareness like, wow, I can't stay in Africa unless I figure out a way to make some money. And I could go home and be broke, or I could stay traveling and be broke. And I figured, let me just stay here. And they invited me to go. And I remember being in South Africa. And this is after I got to visit my brother in India and meet you. And it was the first time I felt a sense of real freedom in my life. And I was working, I was living at the yoga center. I was working at their health food store. They were a wonderful couple that ran the 3HO ashram there. And I felt very free. I was making money. I was living in a foreign country. There was just a sense of real liberation. And I remember walking down from the ashram and went to this dance club that was below the health food store. And I didn't need to drink. I didn't anything. I just danced all night. And this lady who was a DJ, it was the first time I'd seen a woman DJ, and she plays this song, you know, and I haven't been in America for over a year. And I just remember connecting to this song. And I feel like that, what he says in that song was very much the energy I had at 19, going out to the world, feeling like I'm here to change the world. And what's in me is going to come out and I'm going to create a ripple effect on the world. And it was quite naive at the time, but it was also just the charge on my life. And this song always turns me on.
Fake love, no love, you get the slug. CB4 gusto, your luck low. I didn't know till I was drunk though. You weak cats are played out, get robbed and laid out. Gambino turned snitch, I got the bite out. 96 ways I made out. Montana way, the good F-E-L-L-A. Verbal shit, get spray, dip the tattoo. Jump out the range, empty out the ashtray. A glass of Zay, making mad cash. It's clay, red dot plots. Murder schemes, 32 years I rung. Regulate with my 17 rocks. Clean from one ring, yo, let me let y'all people know one thing. There's one life, one love. So
okay, so there's a lot between that and what you're doing now, and I'm gonna ask you about what you're doing now because it's fascinating. I've just been through your website and listened to a couple of things, but I want to stay for a bit with the 3HO, because again, I heard stories over the years and I lived some of it through Prab and our friends. But a lot of things have changed there in the 3HO. You just started a podcast the untold stories, the uncomfortable conversation of the 3HO community. So there's a lot there. Just tell me, you get me to the podcast, whatever way you want to get there, because there's a lot. And we can go into your personal life about your former husband and all that, but it's up to you. You go ahead, because there's a lot there.
Well, let me just trace it back. So what happened was, when I had come back from Africa and stuff, you know, I really wanted to make money. I wanted to learn how to be a business person. I was tired of kind of being the nomadic educator traveler chick. And that really ties into kind of indoctrination I got from 3HO. Was I remember feeling like, wow, if I don't learn some skills of being a business person, I won't be successful, because I remember kind of seeing the dichotomy growing up. Yoga teachers that were kind of impacting, helping, teaching in prisons and schools, they were broke, kind of peasant group of 3HO. And then there was the business people and the people who made money and drove Mercedes. And in my childlike mind, I was like, oh, if you do the philanthropic stuff, you're broke. If you do the business stuff, you make money. And I didn't know that traced back to my childhood, but I definitely know that now. So I ended up getting into this business. And in this decade that I built this business wanting to make residual income, I broke a lot of my own fears that I grew up with, whether it was cutting my hair, wearing nail polish for the first time. Like, I remember being so scared of wearing red nail polish. And looking over at my girlfriend saying, I think I'm going to get red. And she's like, no way. And I'm like, I know. And it just didn't make sense how much fear I held around, quote, mundane things. So that business broke a lot of barriers for me. And I discovered so much more about myself. But fast forward through those years in 2012, when that business came crashing down and I lost all my residual income, I was left with a resounding memory of being ostracized. And it felt like I was on auto repeat of something from my childhood. Like, it was like, whoa, this is familiar. I was getting kicked out of my own business. People that I thought were my family wouldn't talk to me anymore. I mean, just stuff that was like, it had to be my soul talking to me. Like, that's the way I took it. Like, I could, at this moment, I had to choose. I could take the skill sets that I learned and go make more money. I'd build a $1 million business. I can transfer that skill set. I could go make more money somewhere else. But in that moment, I paused and I said, I'm being asked to look at something internally. And while I can stay externally, I felt very discombobulated and I felt like I wasn't anywhere close to the semblance of who I knew I was to be. And So I started digging in, and this is when I ended up doing Kundalini yoga teacher training, because I felt so far away from my own personal center. And I had zero interest in being a Kundalini yoga teacher, like zero. In fact, I had an antithesis of an interest. And I remember Krishna Kaur, you know, I was taking teacher training with her in Los Angeles, and she was just, you're a teacher. And I was like, no, I'm just here to get back to my own center. I have zero interest in teaching this, because I remember taking it and I didn't like the fact that they were teaching Sikh things, that, you know, there were religious aspects still all tied into it. There were just so many things that I was like, God, why are they teaching that in teacher training? That's unfortunate, thinking that we only got that growing up. Why are they repeating this with yoga students? But these are just random questions in my mind in 2009. It took a little while later when my business came crashing down and I really started unwinding this. I had to really ask myself, what is going on? Why don't I want to be a teacher of this stuff? And hypocrisy kind of like started throwing up out of my body. My vitriol or rage around having to wear white or having to wear a turban or being judged if I chose something else. And so I would start teaching students, like, don't wear white because you think it makes you holy. If it resonates with you and you feel a difference, do that. But then I would tell the story, for me, when I wear pink, I vibrate, because I didn't get to wear pink. You know, when I cut my hair, I had an experience of discovering parts of me that I didn't get to. And you might have that experience if you stop cutting your hair and wear a turban in public, because you're breaking your cultural code of conditioning. And I'm making my cultural code of conditioning. So what I started to realize was, on the spectrum of what we've been taught is good, right, and wrong, we all have our fear zones and our comfort zones. And the more we can stretch ourselves into these other spaces, the more we liberate ourselves from where we've been indoctrinated, and the more we discover like the us within the self. Mm. And that's where this podcast comes from, because when I was healing the last few years and I was discovering the trauma and the patterns and the abuse that was living in my body, I didn't know it went back to my childhood. It was only in the last 6 months, when I heard the stories and started piecing 50 years worth of stories together and seeing myself and my brothers and sisters that have been horribly abused, physically or emotionally or sexually. And I felt myself in them. I was like, I do that too. I do that too. I do that too. And in that moment, I realized, wow, none of these things happened to me. I didn't go to India. I didn't get abused, but I'm still holding trauma patterns like they are. And then that made me realize, wow, as a community, we're holding systemic trauma patterns because it's an environmental trauma.
Wow. Tell me, and I will put the links to your podcast on the show notes, because, and I'm going to listen to it myself. I haven't listened to it yet. But, and again, I heard little bits of stories, and without going through the full story, but just recently something quite dramatic happened to the whole community. Am I correct? That something happened pretty big.
Massive. We're having like our own Me Too movement.
Okay.
The difference is that it's 50 years worth of mystical manipulation that's being uncovered. And it's not that these things weren't showing themselves in 1970. They were, but we didn't have the internet. So the adults that were leaving and kind of like the people that had stories, the other communities didn't hear the stories. And then Yogi Bhajan controlled the narrative. So it's really astounding, because no one wants to believe that they're a part of something where they're indoctrinated. You know, everyone wants to think one's a critical thinker, you know, that I'm a self within this collective. But this kind of community upheaval because I had done so much level of trauma work over the last number of years, a lot of this wasn't stirring up my personal trauma. I was able to see it as a collective issue and name it and have words for it. And so that's where the inspiration came from. You know, all these stories were coming out in private Facebook groups, and we were doing private Zoom calls, and people were sharing their raw testimonies. Some people from the 70s and 80s and other people from 2015, you know, the range of generational abuse. And we're having just break open moments of like witnessing and breaking the code of silence that our community has just been choked with and that we're unconsciously conditioned to uphold because we're not comfortable in these uncomfortable sensations and emotions of rage and guilt and shame. And, you know, we harbor it. We've been taught to kind of keep it contained. Wow. So I kind of found myself frustrated by July, like everyone needs to hear these stories, you know, and even more angry that the machine of the organizations covered this stuff up over 30, 40 years. What makes them not want to cover it up now? And the machine keeps going and the teacher trainings keep being taught and kind of the web of, oh, come into the yoga of awareness. We're so pure and white and holy and blah, 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 blah. And then doses of shame are infused within that teacher training for just being human beings that have desire and sensation and things we want to feel and do and have. And, so I wanted to put these stories in public, and it's really out of a place in my heart that comes from a sense of therapy for me, because hearing stories, I feel like we have a chance to weave tapestries together, to see the full story of what really took place.
And that is amazing. I just read some of the comments on the Apple podcast and some of the reviews, but how big is the community now? Am I right in thinking that there's more people living that join, or is it still?
You know, I think that might be, yeah, you know, because I think more people have left over the years, but like we don't even know who all those folks are because it's just been, you know, so many years of a revolving door. But it's huge. You know, it's Derecho has grown super big in Latin America, all through Mexico, all through Europe. And there's whole communities that are just kind of like totally shutting out this conversation, and aren't even looking at the abuse stories at all. And they're just kind of staying with the same 1980s narrative of shame and gaslighting and victim bashing. And, you know, it's so fascinating because I remember that narrative when I was 8 years old, and I'm stunned that it's 2020 and people want to carry it on. You know, but that's really heavy indoctrination, you know. Wow. Brainwashing doesn't just go away. It's a slow unwind.
I'm looking forward to listen to, you have a number of episodes out there already. I'm looking forward to listen to it. But the next song, whether it's linked to this or not, it kind of goes well with it. Unstoppable. Leanne LaHava. It sounds like that's it. You're unstoppable now. You're going to go for it. Tell me all about that song.
Yeah, you know, that song really reminds me of where I was at between 2015 and say 2019, or, you know, pretty close to 2020. So I started teaching Kundalini yoga around like 2012, 13, when my business ended. And I didn't start teaching it because I wanted to be a yoga teacher. I taught it because it was something I could do without offering a lot of my emotional energy. It was like I was osmosis. It just came through me. And as I did that, it gave me access points to myself. And one of the access points I noticed is I couldn't feel my emotional body. I couldn't feel, like I could feel anger in my body. It was showing up as inflammation or indigestion or acid reflux. I could feel it. I could feel it in my joints, but I couldn't feel the emotion or the sensation. And I remember being like, that's strange. And then, you know, random people as I would teach would be like, would just say certain things around my presence, and, you know, different things started getting me kind of noticing, like, what is going on? And so I started getting messages that I shouldn't teach as much, and then I shouldn't practice Kundalini, and then I needed a different something. And I remember finding this work in New York called the School of Womanly Arts, and it started getting me kind of connected to my sensual body, and questions around, like, what gives me pleasure? What gives me desire? What is my desire? What do I want? And I started speaking this language, but I couldn't feel myself. So every time I penetrated myself to be like, what do I desire? What's my pleasure? I couldn't feel myself. All I could feel was shame, and then more shame. And it just felt like an endless pit of shame. And for the next 3-4 years, I started doing different sexual embodiment practices, sexual exploration, different things that were getting me into an exploration of my own sensual body, and specifically in my pelvis. I was working with my pelvis and my sex organs specifically because I felt like there was a huge disconnect. Like, it was almost like it didn't belong to me. Like that was a weird feeling, because on some level, I felt like I was, quote, so embodied. I was a Kundalini yogi, and I was healthy, and I was strong, and I had this strong, powerful projection, and people would always be like, oh, it must have been so amazing, because you're in the Kundalini world. So people are like, it must be so amazing to grow up. By 8, you must have been so enlightened, and just kind of like all these like fantasy projections they're putting on you around. And I mean, what do you do with that? You're just kind of like, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. And I never felt like I felt enlightened. I never felt like I had a Kundalini awakening, like none of these things. I felt like really deep aches inside. And so anyway, this last number of years has been some of the darkest places I've ever gone. I learned about shadow work. I didn't take courses for this stuff. I dove into the abyss of my interior body. And I started digging into the dirt of my own experiences. And I just kept shoveling out more darkness, until I just let myself fall in love in the dark and let this darkness inform me. And whatever I was asked to do, I just listened. And so this song is really about me and my relationship to my soul. It's that nothing made sense. It didn't make sense that so much trauma and darkness kept coming out of my body. And I'm like, what the hell is all this? Like, where is this from? Because remember, at that time, I didn't have a context of saying, oh, my upbringing was a cult. I didn't say that. I thought my upbringing was wonderful. Of course, it has hypocrisy. Of course, it had infidelity. It had other things. But we all have those things. We all have things that weren't that great. I didn't know it was sadistically abusive. I didn't understand the level of psychosomatic disconnection and training we had gotten at the time. So to really listen to my soul, to be told to not work, to not teach, to not be my ambitious, driven self, like literally, Andrea, I was spirit or God or whatever you want to call it, just the messages I was getting was, just rest. Just rest. And I'm like, what do you mean just rest? I got bills. I gotta do something. And they're like, no, you'll be fine. Just rest. And so like some of my practices were intentional. Like instead of taking a cold shower and waking up early, I had to practice taking hot baths and sleeping in.
Stronger, I know it's taking the time to heal. We'll be unstoppable. Don't know what I did it for. I needed to know that it was always real. Our heads held high when we walked down the line, honey, on and on.
Wow, what a story. But it's fascinating that that the way you describe it, listening to it and digging the dirt out of from the inside out. You know, I love that description. I can see it, and again, I'm looking at you, And I'm casting my mind back to, I think it was a train journey to, I can't remember, let's say it was Mysore. We were going somewhere. And here was this kid with a turban on her head. And I don't know what was going on, but I'm just looking at you now and trying to remember you then. But all of this that you've done now is fascinating, because I'm just looking at your website, Guru Nishan. I love that. That is my real name. It is your real name, Guru Nishan. There's not that many around. GuruNishan.com. And you do a lot of different things. Tell me about what you do, because there's some great testimonials there. I love the one one of the speakers' topic is get younger as you age. But tell me what have you created, and it's obviously all informed by all your years of trauma and rebirth and whatever we want to call it. So tell me about it.
Yeah, so I call myself a soul provocateur, an alchemist, and a breath trainer, and basically a teacher of the sensory system or the sensory body. So an alchemist, because essentially digging in the dirt, taking like the hardest, darkest, most dense elements and experiences of our life and transforming them into gold. Like that is the work of the alchemist. And having come from a very spiritually manipulative environment and not knowing that it was manipulative, thinking that that was a healthy example of spirituality, you just don't know what you don't know. If you grow up in abuse, you're normalized to abuse and you just don't know different. And so the soul provocateur is, I've learned that if you're in my presence, I'm going to be seducing your soul out of hiding. It's a part of my gift, you know, that we all have a soul calling on our life, and that isn't a religious belief. So the way I communicate or speak about the soul is, the soul is like our unique pulse. It's our essence. It's our DNA. It's our unique fingerprint. It's the unique life pulse, or that desire pulse that calls us into experiences. And we all have layers of coding that cover us or plaster us over to prevent us from feeling that pulse. So it's called conditioning, our lived experiences. And we all have what I call the unique manufacturing experience, that a computer comes from the manufacturer. We come from our manufacturer. And a lot of our default settings aren't in our own best interest. They're in the best interest of the manufacturer, of the one who tried to condition us. And that our life can, if we choose, we can shed conditioning and have more and more of the soul pulse alive and vibrant and on the surface of our life, instead of hidden underneath the rubble of our conditioning. And so my experience, my lived experience of embodying, of coming back into my body, of having my spirit and my soul living down in my body, and I can feel my body for the first time. I'm 43 years old and I feel like I just inhabited my body for the first time. And that no one else is living in my body than me. And that's a big reclamation for anybody who's experienced trauma, because we learn to not trust our bodies or the sensations of our body. And that's a huge disconnect, because it means living in the body doesn't feel safe. And so soul provocateur is like, oh, when you start seducing your soul, we come out of hiding and more of us shows up. And that's what my life has felt like, that I've been shedding more and more of the stuff that I carried as unconscious baggage, or what I call dead weight, and awaken to my sensory body. And the sensory system is like one of the earliest parts of our system that develops, because the nervous system and the soul nerve, the vagus nerve, that's formed like within 6 days of the fetus developing. And when we're babies, we don't take in the world through our rational mind. Our brain isn't developed. We absorb the world through our sensory body. And so what I've discovered about myself is that most of what I absorbed in the environment was incongruent. It was hypocritical. It was what we saw was one thing, what we heard was another, what we were told was another. And that creates an internal disconnect where I learn to not actually know what to not believe myself. Reclaiming my sexuality, my pleasure, my body, my sovereignty is basically like saying my pleasure is mine and my body is mine. And that's exciting. This is like, it's like I'm here to play in the life that I've claimed.
Brilliant. And I love the way you say in one of your talks, you're talking about, you know, clearing your cookies and your cache, and, you know, but who are you attracting as, who are your clients? Who comes to you? Because, you know, this, I'm kind of closer enough to a similar business. I do coaching and, you know, personal coaching, corporate well-being coaching, etc. But you attract a certain type of person comes to look for you. Who comes to you? Who's looking for your experience? Who have you found so far?
Yeah, well, the main aspect or entry point that I'm working with people is breath training, because it's one of the fastest ways to rewire the brain and the body and to really like get connected to the sensations within our system. The main person that I'm attracting or servicing or helping are actually businessmen that know that there's more out there, know that there's more to themselves, but would never call themselves the yoga meditation type. That's been my main focus, and also just the area that I enjoy the most, because I don't see a lot of support for anyone in male bodies, number one. And there's been a lot of conditioning over the masculine body in terms of what we're allowed to feel, not allowed to feel. And having grown up feeling very masculine in my body and having to like reclaim my own sensations in my body, even though I am a woman, I felt like I was in touch with these feminine aspects of myself. And this is a process of coming back to whole. And that's what I found. I was helping, like a lot of men were coming to me saying, oh my God, what you're saying is the first time this stuff makes sense. It can land in me somewhere. You're talking very technically, you're giving examples of technology, and suddenly this makes sense. It's not all like fluffy and woo woo and out there. It's very technical and grounded. And that's who I think I'm serving the most.
Wonderful. Tell me about your last song. It's Bette Midler, The Rose.
Yeah, so this song feels like a real full circle. This year has been very, very tremendous. As I said, I started my self-pleasure reclamation journey back in 2015, and it kind of carried me through into the beginning of this year. And when this year broke open, it felt like I stepped through a portal into a new dimension. And suddenly I got context for things. What I had been excavating out of my body, I realized were the stories and the abuses and the testimonies of my brothers and sisters and aunties and uncles that weren't mine, but I was living with them in my body. And it gave me a sense of like, wow, I get it. And even just having the language of like, wow, I wasn't raised in a spiritual community. I was raised in a very sadistic cult disguised as a spiritual community. That's incredible. And I was able to see clearly like a new set of grids almost. Like it felt like a world closed and another whole world opened up. And a lot of the fragments of truth that I had been given growing up through the Yogi Bhajan lifestyle, suddenly I was given the real cosmic truths of where those things came from. And one of those was the path of the priestess Rose. And, you know, I don't even know what any of that stuff even meant. And I started to learn like roses and all these things of roses were coming to me. And, you know, this ties back to Mary Magdalene and Mother Mary and all these things that I never understood that there was a whole other path. And so things started just coming to me, and the rose was one of them. And the last number of months have been very, very deeply healing. I realized and said out loud that I grew up and have complex PTSD and have healed myself of so many trauma patterns that I don't recommend people heal on their own. I recommend people get therapy and lots of other support, but that I know that I have gone through these stages to be able to give a better framework of how to become a better self-authority, how to really become the number one authority of our own experience, and then reach out to therapy and support and healers as needed. But none of those people will ever be the authority of ourselves. And so when the rose started coming to me in the last couple of months, I realized, wow, I've been protected and held and loved here the whole time. Mother Mary has been showing herself all these years. My sister is Rose. My auntie is Rose. Another Rose. I just started having flashes of all the roses. And then it brought me back to my childhood. Kind of this full circle moment where the snake sheds its skin, eats itself, and comes back alive in a new form. And when I was young, my dad and my sister, my brother, all of us went to go see the movie, The Rose, with Bette Midler. And, you know, I'm a baby. I'm maybe under two. And I fall asleep through the whole thing. And so there's this internal family joke around this song, because we leave the movie and I wake up and I said the classic line. And the classic line was, "Woes die in movie." And here it's like, it just was this full circle moment. And I realized, oh my God, you know, all of this work has brought me back to my own heart. You know, it brought me back to feeling myself, to feeling my compassionate, to feel my own love, to feel the love that I am, to feel the love that I've always been. And that's what this work is really all about. It's that in all of the challenges of our life, we can still blossom, and we can blossom so beautifully when we reclaim ourself out from the rubble of our experience.
Some say drowns the tender reed. Some say love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say love.
And you're most certainly blossoming, I can tell you that. Absolutely. Just, I want to ask you another thing about, because I always remember we, Prav and I, spent hours and months just talking. I think that's where, although it was 4 years, our relationship, you know, we met there for 4 years, spent time, we ended up sharing a house, but we spent hours and hours talking. And it was always the one thing that fascinated me, Prav, that he was going through that journey already. Now listen to your story, and I'm trying to recollecting things that he said at the time and that didn't make any sense then. But I always remember that the thing about the spirituality, he's a very spiritual man. I always consider him being spiritual in his own way. But what is happening now with all of you guys that are moved out of the cult or whatever it's called, and how, you know, where are the missing pieces? Where is that spirituality? Is there something missing there that you're trying to recreate amongst yourselves? Or, you know, aside from all the trauma, but the best bits that were there, how are you missing them? How are you recreating them as a group?
Yeah, let me just qualify that to say, you know, as much as there's a ton of things that I think every one of us will glean as wonderful and amazing about the way we were raised, I feel like we're at a stage where it's important to stay talking about the things that weren't good.
Okay.
And specifically because we have a long history of going to the things that were good.
Okay.
So our neuro pattern is find the good. And that's so much a part of the earliest training we got. So I think it's more valuable for us to actually stay in the uncomfortable swamp of, holy smokes, there was a lot going on that we numbed out to, not because we learned to numb out, but it was matched and modeled to us. And so in the healing process, there comes a stage where the good starts getting extracted. But what I've discovered in healing is that if you jump to that stage too fast, you miss the richness of the darkness disassembling you. And that disassembly is so necessary, because then we're not bypassing the pain to find the good. We're actually alchemizing the pain. And the difference is really important, because spiritual bypassing is an epidemic in spiritual communities, not just our community. In all around the world, you know, we want to jump to forgiveness. Oh, forgive, you know, and it's like, no, that's not how the human body works. Mm-hmm. The body needs to grieve. It needs to feel. It needs to have an experience. And trauma theory is showing us that trauma isn't this one event that was so horrific. Trauma is just an experience that the body received as traumatic. It might not have actually been. Because whether it was real or imagined, if the body experiences it as such, it's just a moment in time that's trapped. And we need to give ourselves the permission to feel it. And then the untrapped energy goes. It's just energy stored. And to me, that's such a better approach to looking at it, because, wow, if I let myself feel the uncomfortable feeling, out of that, beneath that sensation, is going to come so much richness of things that actually supported and informed our life. And I can go there, because I think there's so many things about our lifestyle that was amazing. And I think the main thing is each other. The community is each other. You know, it wasn't Yogi Bhajan. The people built the companies. The people built the communities. You know, yes, the people stopped listening to themselves, and they were only listening to YB, but a lot of the younger generation, starting with Prabh's generation, created a bonds of a community, regardless of what the larger organization was doing. And whether somebody was in the Dharma or out of the Dharma, we fostered and maintained our relationships. And I think now that there's real truth and all the truth, the shadow and the light are being talked about, it allows those relationships to go even deeper. Because it means that we're not just gleaming the good and not just staying on the positive, but talking about the hard stuff, the social fabric that connects us. And that stuff isn't easy. You know, it's like what we're seeing on a global level. When we can talk about the uncomfortable truths of real life situations where certain bodies are being murdered and other bodies aren't, to pretend that that's not real isn't dealing with reality. And so when we get to deal with reality, bonds get actually deeper, because real vulnerability comes out. We experience each other's hearts and each other's pains and each other's struggles. And historically, at least for me, I didn't know how to show my vulnerability, because I learned that I wasn't allowed to be emotional or to share my feelings. And what kind of bonds do you really get if you never go there with someone?
Yeah. And vulnerability is freedom, isn't it? Vulnerability is freedom. It's fantastic. Look, I'm so appreciative of you telling us all of this, because it's something that, and I've been meaning, and I know I will be talking to Prabh, to Dida, to Kasia, and we still have every now and then we all get together, Guru Kiran and everybody, and it's fantastic. But the last couple of times we spoke, they were talking about it, and I knew there was something. I didn't know exactly what was going on, but it was like, oh, this is big. There's something big going on. And it was such a shame. I've been seeing it over the years. I've been kind of seeing things happening. But look, that's what happened. And tell me something about your book, The Big Leap, Conquer Your Hidden Fear and Take Life to the Next Level by Gay Hendricks.
Yeah, so this book has really been a game changer for me over the last number of years. And I just liked some of the concepts. And one of the concepts is this idea of havingness level. It's kind of like we all have a temperature gauge around things that we'll allow into our experience. And so it's similar to like when you set a temperature gauge of your house and then the temperature drops below that, it's going to bring you right back to that level, but not higher. So we all have a comfort zone or a havingness level in different aspects of our life. So in financial, how much we'll allow ourselves to have before we reach our uncomfortable place and then have to bring ourselves back to that level, or in relationships or intimacy or love or health. And so what I've realized during my pleasure research journey in the last 5 years was that my havingness level for my health was astounding. It was so big. Nobody could ever tell me that I have some disease and I would believe them. Now, it doesn't mean I wouldn't get other recommendations and look further into it, but that my knowing, my truth of my body was so strong that there was no authority outside of me that could tell me otherwise. And I kind of got that. But when it came to, say, like finances, my havingness level was not very good. And when it came to intimacy or letting love in, my havingness level was very low. And so I had to like examine that. And the way I talk about it in my work is I take radical responsibility for my own life and my own body and my own experience. And that's not meant to shame anybody who's gone through experiences and is not able to heal. So healing trauma is lifetimes of work, sometimes several lifetimes, and some people will never heal in this lifetime, and that's okay. But I know that when we own our experience and start dissolving the parts that bind us, there's a level of freedom to that that I literally have experienced in my body. And that book just gave me a lens on it that just said, wow, I can be really good in this arena and not really good here. What do I need to do to keep building my bandwidth or building my capacity to let in more? And this is what helped me kind of dig into my trauma as I started realizing, wow, what am I blocking? Here I'm craving connection and I'm blocking it simultaneously. Isn't that interesting? And I would watch myself do this and slowly unwind, which again, I didn't know it was a trauma pattern. I thought it was just something I had learned to do to protect myself. But I didn't know that other brothers and sisters of mine were blocked in their heart or blocked emotionally or had learned to contain themselves in very similar protective ways. So this book was just awesome. It gave me context. And there's a story he tells in that book where this couple is like, you know, they have a lot of money, but they always fight over particular type of toilet paper. So the guy didn't want to buy the expensive plush toilet paper. He wanted the cheap one ply. And, you know, they had plenty of money. You know, when they bought a stereo, they would buy any stereo. It was just this issue with the toilet paper. And in that book, he describes, you know, that this guy had a historical story around what he's allowed to spend on the basic needs. And in order to really track why we do what we do, why we block what we block, why we operate the way we operate, looking at our havingness levels and saying, yeah, I don't tolerate much in that arena. And I self-sabotage, you know, oh, I'm starting to make money. Oh, let me quickly self-sabotage and bring myself back to my normal state. And we don't know we're doing it, but we all do it all the time in so many different arenas of our life.
Well, fascinating. I'm sure your clients are more than they're very fortunate to have you, because I can listen to you all day. You have so much wisdom. It's fabulous. And in fact, that's what I always ask my guests. The last thing I ask everybody is words of wisdom, anything, a quote, anything that gets you up in the morning. What would you have? Anything at all?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest thing I'd say is don't be afraid to go inside and deal with the hard things. You know, your roots create your fruits. And
nice.
It's easier to stay on the external, you know, like we want to change ourselves from the outside in. We want to lose weight. And we're at this time of the year, everyone's, oh, I want this and I want this. And, you know, going into the interior of our experience and unwinding stories that we tell ourselves or that we've been told, this is the recipe for perennial joy. You know, you plant the seeds and you nourish those seeds internally, and the soil is where magic is birthed. You know, in the dark is where the baby comes through the canal, you know. And I think we just have a real misunderstanding around what transformation is. Transformation is death. Parts die. You know, things crack open, realities break, relationships disintegrate, identities dissolve. Like, this stuff sounds so yummy spiritually, but physically it's the hardest shit ever. And I get why people don't do it. I get why people just stay external and numb out. But the truth is, the depth of richness that comes from nourishing our own soil and allowing our seeds to break open and blossom, it's, to me, it's why we're in these bodies in the first place. What else is the point?
Wonderful. Listen, before I let you go, what color and nail polish are you going to use today?
Red. Thank you very much. So red's my favorite color. I've had so much fun discovering my hair. You know, before I cut my hair for the first time, I didn't even have curly hair. I had straight hair. And now, you know, it's like you just don't know what gets to blossom in our lives when we break our own code of unconscious fears that hold us back from being. And I just love it. I love this conversation. I love the experience of leaning into places that we're afraid of and realizing that our greatest gem was there beneath that hard stuff.
Absolutely. Well, Guru Nishan, thanks a million for spending time with me. And it's been an absolute pleasure to see you again. We will keep in touch now that we have each other's contact. And I'll definitely listen to your podcast. I'm fascinated by the whole story. So thanks a million again.
Oh, my God. So my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on today.
The sun still shines in your hair. Kiss you once, then I'll say goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Social Fabric with me, Andrea Splendori. Please visit andreasplendori.com.
Here, if I meet you someplace far down the line, the sun still shines in your face. I'll kiss you once, then I'll say goodnight.